Brady, that he knows Brady has probably gone to the hunting camp, that he will pass this information on to the police soon if he hasn't already, but will any of those things stop Brady? Of course not. Jerome is in Arizona, building houses, Habitat for Humanity.
How socially conscious of him. I was hoping he'd be with you. How badly hurt is his sister?
Broken leg. She'll be up and walking in no time.
That's a shame.
She was one of your test cases, wasn't she?
She got one of the original Zappets, yes. There were 12 of them. Like the 12 apostles, you might say, going forth to spread the word. Sit in the chair in front of the TV, Detective Hodges.
I'd rather not. All my favorite shows are on Monday. Brady smiles politely.
Sit.
Hodges sits, bracing his good hand on the table beside the chair. Going down is agony, but once he actually makes it, sitting is a little better. The TV is off, but he stares at it anyway. Where's the camera?
On the signpost where the road splits, above the arrows. You don't have to feel bad about missing it. It was covered with snow. Nothing sticking out but the lens, and your headlights were off by then.
Is there any Babineau left inside you?
He shrugs. Bits and pieces. Every now and then there's a small scream from the part that thinks it's still alive.
It will stop soon. Jesus, Hodges mutters. Brady drops to one knee, the barrel of the scar resting on his thigh and still pointing at Hodges. He pulls down the back of Holly's coat and examines the tag.
H. Gibney, he says. Printed in indelible ink. Very tidy. Won't wash off in the laundry. I like a person who takes care of her things.
Hodges closes his eyes. The pain is very bad, and he would give everything he owns to get away from it and from what is going to happen next. He would give anything to just sleep, and sleep, and sleep. But he opens them again and forces himself to look at Brady because you play the game to the end. That's how it works. Play to the end.
I have a lot of stuff to do in the next 48 or 72 hours, Detective Hodges. But I'm going to put it on hold in order to deal with you. Does that make you feel special?
It should, because I owe you so much for fucking me over. You need to remember that you came to me, Hodges says. You were the one who started the ball rolling with that stupid bragging letter, not me, you. Babineau's face, the craggy face of an older character actor, darkens.
I suppose you might have a point, but look who's on top now. Look who wins,
Detective Hodges. If you call getting a bunch of stupid, confused kids to commit suicide winning, I guess you're the winner. Me, I think doing that is about as challenging as striking out the pitcher.
It's control. I assert control. You tried to stop me, and you couldn't. You absolutely couldn't, and neither could she.
He kicks Holly in the side.
Her body rolls a boneless half a turn toward the fireplace, then rolls back again. Her face is ashen, her closed eyes sunk deep in their sockets. She actually made me better. Better than I ever was.
Then for Christ's sake, stop kicking her, Hodges shouts. Brady's anger and excitement have caused Babineau's face to flush. His hands are tight on the assault rifle. He takes a deep, steadying breath, then another, and smiles.
Got a soft spot for Ms. Gibney, do you?
He kicks her again, this time in the hip.
Are you fucking her? Is that it? She's not much in the looks department, but I guess a guy your age has to take what he can get. You know what we used to say? Put a flag over her face and fuck her for old glory.
He kicks Holly again and bares his teeth at Hodges in what he may think is a smile.
You used to ask me if I was fucking my mother, remember? All those visits you made to my room, asking if I was fucking the only person who ever cared a damn for me. Talking about how hot she looked, and was she a hoochie mama? asking if I was faking, telling me how much you hoped I was suffering. And I just had to sit there and take it.
He's getting ready to kick poor Holly again. To distract him, Hodges says, there was a nurse, Sadie McDonald. Did you nudge her into killing herself? You did, didn't you? She was the first one.
Brady likes that, and shows even more of Babineau's expensive dental work. It was easy. It always is, once you get inside and start pulling the levers.
How do you do that, Brady? How do you get inside? How did you manage to get those Zappets from Sunrise Solutions and rig them? Oh, and the website, how about that?
Brady laughs. You've read too many of those mystery stories, where the clever private eye keeps the insane murderer talking until help arrives. Or until the murderer's attention wavers, and the private eye can grapple with him and get his gun away.
I don't think help is going to arrive, and you don't look capable of grappling with a goldfish. Besides, you know most of it already. You wouldn't be here if you didn't. Freddy spilled her guts, and not to sound like Snidely Whiplash, she will pay for that, eventually.
She claims she didn't set up the website.
I didn't need her for that. I did it all by myself in Babineau's study on Babineau's laptop during one of my vacations from room 217.
What about...
Shut up! See that table beside you, Detective Hodges?
It's cherry wood like the buffet and looks expensive, but there are faded rings all over it from glasses that were put down without benefit of coasters. The doctors who own this place may be meticulous in operating rooms, but out here they're slobs. On top of it now is the TV remote and a ceramic skull pin holder.
Open the drawer.
Hodges does. Inside is a pink Zappet Commander, sitting on top of an ancient TV guide with Hugh Laurie on the cover.
Take it out and turn it on.
No.
All right, fine. I'll just take care of Ms. Gibney, then.
He lowers the barrel of the scar and points it at the back of Holly's neck.
On full auto, this will rip her head right off. Will it fly into the fireplace? Let's find out.
Okay, Hodges says. Okay, stop. He takes the Zappet and finds the button at the top of the console. The welcome screen lights up. The diagonal downstroke of the red Z fills the screen. He is invited to swipe and access the games. He does so without being prompted by Brady. Sweat pours down his face. He has never been so hot. His broken wrist throbs and pulses.
Do you see the fishing hole icon?
Yes. Opening fishing hole is the last thing he wants to do. But when the alternative is just sitting here with his broken wrist and his swollen, pulsing gut and watching a stream of high-caliber bullets divide Holly's head from her slight body, not an option. And besides, he has read a person can't be hypnotized against his will. It's true that Dinah Scott's console almost put him under, but then he didn't know what was happening. Now he does. And if Brady thinks he's tranced out, and he's not, then maybe, just maybe.
I'm sure you know the drill by now,
Brady says. His eyes are bright and lively, the eyes of a boy who's about to set a spider web on fire so he can see what the spider will do. Will it scurry around its flaming web, looking for a way to escape, or will it just burn?
Tap the icon. The fish will swim, and the music will play. Tap the pink fish and add up the numbers. In order to win the game, you have to score 120 points in 120 seconds. If you succeed, I'll let Ms. Gibney live. If you fail, we'll see what this fine automatic weapon can do.
Babineau saw it demolish a stack of concrete blocks once, so just imagine what it will do to flesh.
You're not going to let her live even if I score 5,000, Hodges says. I don't believe that for a second. Babineau's blue eyes widen in mock outrage.
But you should. All that I am, I owe to this bitch sprawled out in front of me. The least I can do is spare her life. Assuming she isn't suffering a brain bleed and dying already, that is.
Now stop playing for time. Play the game instead.
Your 120-second start as soon as your finger taps the icon.
With no other recourse, Hodges taps it. The screen blanks. There's a blue flash so bright it makes him squint. And then the fish are there, swimming back and forth, up and down, crisscrossing, sending up silvery trails of bubbles. The music begins to tinkle.
By the sea, by the beautiful sea.
Only it isn't just music. There are words mixed in, and there are words in the blue flashes, too.
10 seconds gone, Brady says. Tick-tock, tick-tock.
Hodges taps at one of the pink fish and misses. He's right-hand dominant, and each tap makes the throbbing in his wrist that much worse, but the pain there is nothing compared to the pain now roasting him from groin to throat. On his third try, he gets a pinky. That's how he thinks of them, as pinkies. And the fish turns into a number 5. He says it out loud.
Only 5 points in 20 seconds? Brady says. Better step it up, detective.
Hodges taps faster, eyes moving left and right, up and down. He no longer has to squint when the blue flashes come because he's used to them. And it's getting easier. The fish seem bigger now, also a little slower. The music seems less tinkly, fuller somehow.
You and me, oh how happy we'll be.
Is that Brady's voice singing along with the music, or just his imagination? Live or Memorex? No time to think about it now. Tempus is fugiting. He gets a 7 fish, then a 4, and then jackpot. 1 turns into a 12. He says, I'm up to 27. But is that right? He's losing count. Brady doesn't tell him. Brady only says,
80 seconds to go.
And now his voice seems to have picked up a slight echo, as if it's coming to Hodges from the far end of a long hallway. Meanwhile, a marvelous thing is happening. The pain in his gut is starting to recede. Whoa, he thinks. The AMA should know about this. He gets another pinky. It turns into a 2. Not so good, but there are plenty more. Plenty, plenty more. That's when he starts to feel something like fingers fluttering delicately inside his head. And it's not his imagination. He's being invaded.
It was easy, Brady said of Nurse MacDonald. It always is, once you get inside and start pulling the levers.
And when Brady gets to his levers? He'll jump inside me the way he jumped inside Babineau, Hodges thinks. Although this realization is now like the voice and the music coming from the far end of a long hallway. At the end of that hallway is the door to room 217, and the door is standing open. Why would he want to do that? Why would he want to inhabit a body that's turned into a cancer factory? Because he wants me to kill Holly. Not with the gun, though. He'd never trust me with that. He'll use my hands to choke her. Broken wrist and all. Then he'll leave me to face what I've done.
You're getting better, Detective Hodges. And you still have a minute to go. Just relax and keep tapping. It's easier when you relax.
The voice is no longer echoing down a hallway. Even though Brady is now standing right in front of him, it's coming from a galaxy far, far away. Brady bends down and stares eagerly into Hodges' face. Only there are fish swimming between them. Pinkies and blueies and reddies. Because Hodges is in the fishing hole now. Except it's really an aquarium and he's the fish. Soon he will be eaten. Eaten alive.
Come on, Billy boy. Tap those pink fish.
I can't let him inside me, Hodges thinks. But I can't keep him out. He taps a pink fish. It turns into a 9. And it isn't just fingers he feels now, but another consciousness spilling into his mind. It's spreading like ink in water. Hodges tries to fight and knows he will lose. The strength of that invading personality is incredible. I'm going to drown. Drown in the fishing hole. Drown in Brady Hart's field.
By the sea, by the sea, by the beautiful sea.
A pane of glass shatters close by. It's followed by a jubilant chorus of boys shouting, "That's a home run!" The bond binding Hodges to Hartsfield is broken by the pure, unexpected surprise of the thing. Hodges jerks back in the chair and looks up as Brady wheels toward the couch, eyes wide and mouth open in startlement. The Victory 38, held against the small of his back only by its short barrel, the cylinder won't allow it to go deeper, falls out of his belt and thumps to the bearskin rug. Hodges doesn't hesitate. He throws the Zappit into the fireplace.
"Don't you do that!"
Brady bellows, turning back. He raises the scar.
"Don't you fucking dare!"
Hodges grasps the nearest thing to hand, not the 38, but the ceramic pin holder. There's nothing wrong with his left wrist, and the range is short. He throws it at the face Brady has stolen. He throws it hard and connects dead center. The ceramic skull shatters. Brady screams. Pain, yes, but mostly shock, and his nose begins to gush blood. When he tries to bring up the scar, Hodges pistons out his feet, enduring another deep gore of that bull's horn, and smashes them into Brady's chest. Brady backpedals, almost catches his balance, then trips over a hassock and sprawls on the bearskin rug. Hodges tries to launch himself out of the chair and only succeeds in overturning the end table. He goes to his knees as Brady sits up, bringing the scar around. There's a gunshot before he can level it on Hodges, and Brady screams again. This time it's all pain. He looks unbelievingly at his shoulder where blood is pouring through a hole in his shirt. Holly is sitting up. There's a grotesque bruise over her left eye in almost the same place as the one on Freddy's forehead. That left eye is red, filled with blood, but the other is bright and aware. She's holding the Victory 38 in both hands.
"Shoot him again," Hodges roars. "Shoot him again, Holly."
As Brady lurches to his feet, one hand clapped to the wound in his shoulder, the other holding the scar, face slack with disbelief, Holly fires again. This bullet goes way high, ricocheting off the field stone chimney above the roaring fire.
"Stop that!"
Brady shouts, ducking. At the same time, he's struggling to raise the scar.
"Stop doing that, you bit!"
Holly fires a third time. The sleeve of Brady's shirt twitches and he yelps. Hodges isn't sure she's winged him again, but she at least grooved him. Hodges gets to his feet and tries to run at Brady, who is making another effort to raise the automatic rifle. The best he can manage is a slow plod.
"You're in the way," Holly cries. "Bill, you're in the fracking way."
Hodges drops to his knees and tucks his head. Brady turns and runs. The 38 bangs. Wood splinters fly from the door frame a foot to Brady's right. Then he's gone. The front door opens, cold air rushes in, making the fire do an excited shimmy.
"I missed him,"
Holly shouts, agonized.
"Stupid and useless, stupid and useless."
She drops the Victory and slaps herself across the face. Hodges catches her hand before she can do it again and kneels beside her. "No, you got him at least once, maybe twice. You're the reason we're still alive. But for how long?" Brady held on to that goddamn grease gun. He may have an extra clip or two, and Hodges knows he wasn't lying about the Scar 17S's ability to demolish concrete blocks. He has seen a similar assault rifle, the HK-416, do exactly that at a private shooting facility in the wilds of Victory County. He went there with Pete, and on the way back they joked about how the HK should be standard police issue.
"What do we do?"
Holly asks.
"What do we do now?"
Hodges picks up the 38 and rolls the barrel. Two rounds left, and the 38 is only good at short range anyway. Holly has a concussion at the very least, and he's almost incapacitated. The bitter truth is this. They had a chance, and Brady got away. He hugs her and says, "I don't know."
"Maybe we should hide."
"I don't think that would work," he says, but doesn't say why, and is relieved when she doesn't ask. It's because there's still a little of Brady left inside of him. It probably won't last long, but for the time being, at least, Hodges suspects it's as good as a homing beacon.
32. Brady staggers through shin-deep snow, eyes wide with disbelief. Babineau's 63-year-old heart banging away in his chest. There's a metallic taste on his tongue. His shoulder is burning. And the thought running through his head on a constant loop is, that bitch, that bitch, that dirty sneaking bitch. Why didn't I kill her while I had the chance? The Zappet is gone, too. Good old Zappet Zero. And it's the only one he brought. Without it, he has no way to reach the minds of those with active Zappets. He stands panting in front of heads and skins, coatless in the rising wind and driving snow. The keys to Z-Boy's car are in his pocket, along with another clip for the scar, but what good are the keys? That shitbox wouldn't make it halfway up the first hill before it got stuck. I have to take them, he thinks, and not just because they owe me. The SUV Hodges drove down here is the only way out of here, and either he or the bitch probably has the keys. It's possible they left them in the vehicle, but that's a chance I can't afford to take. Besides, it would mean leaving them alive. He knows what he has to do, and switches the fire control to full auto. He socks the butt of the scar against his good shoulder and starts shooting, raking the barrel from left to right, but concentrating on the great room where he left them. Gunfire lights up the night, turning the fast-falling snow into a series of flash photographs. The sound of the overlapping reports is deafening. Windows explode inward. Clapboards rise from the facade like bats. The front door left half open and his escape flies all the way back, rebounds, and is driven back again. Babineau's face is twisted in an expression of joyful hate that is all Brady Hartsfield, and he doesn't hear the growl of an approaching engine or the clatter of steel treads from behind him. 33. Down, Hodges shouts. Holly, down! He doesn't wait to see if she'll obey on her own, just lands on top of her and covers her body with his. Above them, the living room is a storm of flying splinters, broken glass, and chips of rock from the chimney. An elk's head falls off the wall and lands on the hearth. One glass eye has been shattered by a Winchester slug, and it looks like it's winking at them. Holly screams. Half a dozen bottles on the buffet explode, releasing the stench of bourbon and gin. A slug strikes a burning log in the fireplace, bursting it in two and sending up a storm of sparks. Please let him just have the one clip, Hodges thinks, and if he aims low, let him hit me instead of Holly. Only a .308 Winchester slug that hits him will go through them both, and he knows it. The gunfire stops. Is he reloading, or is he out? Live or Memorex?
Bill, get off me. I can't breathe.
Better not. He says,
What's that? What's that sound?
And then, answering her own question,
someone's coming.
Now that his ears are clearing a little, Hodges can hear it too. At first he thinks it must be Thurston's grandson on one of the snowmobiles the old man mentioned, and about to be slaughtered for trying to play Good Samaritan. But maybe not. The approaching engine sounds too heavy for a snowmobile. Bright yellow-white light floods in through the shattered windows like the spotlights from a police helicopter. Only this is no helicopter. 34. Brady is ramming his extra clip home when he finally registers the growl and clank of the approaching vehicle. He whirls, wounded shoulder throbbing like an infected tooth, just as a huge silhouette appears at the end of the camp road. The headlamps dazzle him. His shadow leaps out long on the sparkling snow as the whatever it is comes rolling toward the shot-up house, throwing gouts of snow behind its clanking treads. And it's not just coming at the house. It's coming at him. He depresses the trigger and the scar resumes its thunder. Now he can see it's some kind of snow machine with a bright orange cabin sitting high above the churning treads. The windshield explodes just as someone dives for safety from the open driver's side door. The monstrosity keeps coming. Brady tries to run, and Babineau's expensive loafers slip. He flails, staring at those oncoming headlights, and goes down on his back. The orange invader rises above him. He sees a steel tread whirring toward him. He tries to push it away, as he sometimes pushed objects in his room. The blinds, the bedclothes,
the door to the bathroom, but it's like trying to beat off a charging lion with a toothbrush. He raises a hand and draws in breath to scream. Before he can, the left tread of the Tucker Snowcat rolls over his midsection and chews it open.
35. Holly has zero doubt concerning the identity of their rescuer and doesn't hesitate. She runs through the bullet-pocked foyer and out the front door, crying his name over and over. Jerome looks as if he's been dusted in powdered sugar when he picks himself up. She's sobbing and laughing as she throws herself into his arms.
How did you know? How did you know to come?
I didn't, he says. It was Barbara. When I called to say I was coming home, she told me I had to go after you or Brady would kill you. Only she called him the voice. She was half crazy. Hodges is making his way toward the two of them at a slow stagger, but he's close enough to overhear this and remembers that Barbara told Holly some of that suicide voice was still inside her, like a trail of slime, she said. Hodges knows what she was talking about because he's got some of that disgusting thought snot in his own head, at least for the time being. Maybe Barbara had just enough of a connection to know that Brady was lying in wait. Or hell, maybe it was pure woman's intuition. Hodges actually believes in such a thing. He's old school. Jerome, he says. The word comes out in a dusty croak. My man. His knees unlock. He's going down. Jerome frees himself from Holly's death grip and puts an arm around Hodges before he can. Are you all right? I mean, I know you're not all right, but are you shot? No, Hodges puts his own arm around Holly. And I should have known you'd come. Neither one of your minds worth a tinker's damn.
Couldn't break up the band before the final reunion concert, could we?
Jerome says. Let's get you in the... There comes an animal sound from their left. A guttural groan that struggles to be words and can't make it. Hodges is more exhausted than ever in his life, but he walks toward that groan anyway because... Well, because... What was the word he used with Holly on their way out here? Closure, wasn't it? Brady's hijacked body has been laid open to the backbone. His guts are spread out around him like the wings of a red dragon. Pools of steaming blood are sinking into the snow. But his eyes are open and aware, and all at once Hodges can feel those fingers again. This time they're not just probing lazily. This time they're frantic, scrabbling for purchase. Hodges ejects them as easily as that floor-mopping orderly once pushed this man's presence out of his mind. He spits Brady out like a watermelon seed.
Help me, Brady whispers. You have to help me.
I think you're way beyond help, Hodges says. You were run down, Brady. Run down by an extremely heavy vehicle. Now you know what that feels like, don't you?
Hurts,
Brady whispers. Yes, Hodges says. I imagine it does.
If you can't help me, shoot me.
Hodges holds out his hand, and Holly puts the Victory 38 into it like a nurse handing a doctor a scalpel. He rolls the cylinder and dumps out one of the two remaining bullets. Then he closes the gun up again. Although he hurts everywhere now, hurts like hell, Hodges kneels down and puts his father's gun in Brady's hand. You do it, he says. It's what you always wanted. Jerome stands by, ready in case Brady should decide to use that final round on Hodges instead. But he doesn't. Brady tries to point the gun at his head. He can't. His arm twitches, but won't rise. He groans again. Blood pours over his lower lip and seeps out from between Felix Babineau's capped teeth. It would almost be possible to feel sorry for him, Hodges thinks, if you didn't know what he did at City Center, what he tried to do at the Mingo Auditorium, and the suicide machine he set in motion today. That machine will slow down and stop now that its prime operative is finished, but it will swallow up a few more sad young people before it does. Hodges is pretty sure of that. Suicide may not be painless, but it is catching. You could feel sorry for him if he wasn't a monster, Hodges thinks.
Holly kneels, lifts Brady's hand, and puts the muzzle of the gun against his temple. Now, Mr. Hartsfield, she says, you have to do the rest yourself, and may God have mercy on your soul.
I hope not, Jerome says, in the glare of the snowcat's headlights, his face is a stone. For a long moment, the only sounds are the rumble of the snow machine's big engine and the rising wind of Winter Storm Eugenie.
Holly says, oh God, his finger's not even on the trigger. One of you needs to help me. I don't think I can.
Then, a gunshot.
Brady's last trick, Jerome says. Jesus.
36. There's no way Hodges can make it back to the expedition, but Jerome is able to muscle him into the cab of the snowcat. Holly sits beside him on the outside. Jerome climbs behind the wheel and throws it into gear. Although he backs up and then circles wide around the remains of Babineau's body, he tells Holly not to look until they're at least up the first hill.
We're leaving blood tracks.
Oof.
Correct, Jerome says.
Oof is correct. Thurston told me he had snowmobiles, Hodges says. He didn't mention anything about a Sherman tank.
It's a Tucker snowcat, and you didn't offer him your MasterCard as collateral. Not to mention an excellent Jeep Wrangler that got me out here to the Willywags just fine, thanks.
Is he really dead?
Holly asks. Her wan face is turned up to Hodges, and the huge knot on her forehead actually seems to be pulsing.
Really, and for sure.
You saw him put a bullet in his brain.
Yes, but is he? Really, and for sure.
The answer he won't give is no, not yet. Not until the trails of slime he's left in the heads of God knows how many people are washed away by the brain's remarkable ability to heal itself. But in another week, another month at the outside, Brady will be all gone. Yes, he says. And Holly, thanks for programming that text alert, the home run, boys.
She smiles. What was it? The text, I mean.
Hodges struggles his phone out of his coat pocket, checks it, and says, I will be goddamned. He begins to laugh. I completely forgot.
What? Show me, show me, show me.
He tilts the phone so she can read the text his daughter Allison has sent him from California, where the sun is no doubt shining.
Happy birthday, Daddy. 70 years old and still going strong. I'm rushing out to the market. We'll call you later. XXX Allie.
For the first time since Jerome returned from Arizona, Tyrone Feel Good Delight makes an appearance.
You is 70 years old, Master Hodges? Laws! You don't look a day over 65.
Stop it, Jerome, Holly says. I know it amuses you, but that sort of talk sounds very ignorant and silly.
Hodges laughs. It hurts to laugh, but he can't help it. He holds on to consciousness all the way back to Thurston's garage, is even able to take a few shallow tokes on the joint Holly lights and passes to him. Then the dark begins to slip in. This could be it, he thinks. Happy birthday to me, he thinks. Then he's gone.
After. 4 days later.
Pete Huntley is far less familiar with Kiner Memorial than his old partner who made many pilgrimages here to visit a long-term resident who has now passed away. It takes Pete two stops, one at the main desk and one in oncology, before he locates Hodges' room, and when he gets there, it's empty. A cluster of balloons with Happy Birthday Dad on them are tethered to one of the side rails and floating near the ceiling. A nurse pokes her head in, sees him looking at the empty bed, and gives him a smile.
The solarium at the end of the hall. They've been having a little party. I think you're still in time.
Pete walks down.
The solarium is skylighted and filled with plants, maybe to cheer up the patients, maybe to provide them with a little extra oxygen, maybe both. Near one wall, a party of four is playing cards. Two of them are bald, and one has an IV drip running into his arm. Hodges is seated directly under the skylight, doling out slices of cake to his posse, Holly, Jerome, and Barbara. Kermit seems to be growing a beard. It's coming in snow white, and Pete has a brief memory of going to the mall with his own kids to see Santa Claus.
"Pete," Hodges says, smiling. He starts to get up, and Pete waves him back into his seat. "Sit down. Have some cake. Allie brought it from Batool's Bakery. It was always her favorite place to go when she was growing up."
"Where is she?"
Pete asks, dragging a chair over and placing it next to Holly.
She's sporting a bandage on the left side of her forehead, and Barbara has a cast on her leg. Only Jerome looks hale and hearty, and Pete knows the kid barely escaped getting turned into hamburger out at that hunting camp.
"She went back to the coast this morning. 2 days off was all she could manage. She's got 3 weeks vacation coming in March and says she'll be back, if I need her, that is."
"How are you feeling?"
"Not bad," Hodges says. His eyes flick up and to the left, but only for a second. "I've got 3 cancer docs on my case, and the first test came back looking good."
"That's fantastic."
Pete takes the piece of cake Hodges is holding out. "This is too big." "Man up and chow down," Hodges says. "Listen, about you and Izzy..."
"We worked it out," Pete says. He takes a bite. "Hey, nice. There's nothing like carrot cake with cream cheese frosting to cheer up your blood sugar."
"So the retirement party is..."
"Back on. Officially, it was never off. I'm still counting on you to give the first toast, and remember..."
"Yeah, yeah. Ex-wife and current squeeze both there. Nothing too off-color. Got it, got it."
"Just as long as we're clear on that."
The too big slice of cake is getting smaller. Barbara watches the rapid intake with fascination.
"Are we in trouble?"
Holly asks.
"Are we, Pete? Are we?"
"Nope," Pete says. "Completely in the clear. That's mostly what I came to tell you."
Holly sits back with a sigh of relief that blows the graying bangs off her forehead.
"Bet they've got Babineau carrying the can for everything," Jerome says. Pete points his plastic fork at Jerome. "Truth you speak, young Jedi warrior."
"You might be interested to know that the famous puppeteer Frank Oz did Yoda's voice," Holly says. She looks around. "Well, I find it interesting."
"I find this cake interesting," Pete says.
"Could I have a little more? Maybe just a sliver?"
Barbara does the honors, and it's far more than a sliver, but Pete doesn't object. He takes a bite and asks how she's doing. "Good," Jerome says before she can answer. "She's got a boyfriend, kid named Derice Neville, big basketball star."
"Shut up, Jerome. He's not my boyfriend."
"He sure visits like a boyfriend," Jerome says. "I'm talking every day since you broke your leg."
"We have a lot to talk about,"
Barbara says in a dignified tone of voice.
Pete says, "Going back to Babineau, hospital administration has some security footage of him coming in through a back entrance on the night his wife was murdered. He changed into maintenance worker duds, probably raided a locker. He leaves, comes back 15 or 20 minutes later, changes back into the clothes he came in, leaves for good."
"No other footage?" Hodges asks. "Like in the bucket?"
"Yeah, some, but you can't see his face in that stuff because he's wearing a groundhog's cap, and you don't see him go into Harsfield's room. A defense lawyer might be able to make something of that stuff, but since Babineau's never going to stand trial..."
"No one gives much of a shit," Hodges finishes.
"Correct. City and state cops are delighted to let him carry the weight. Izzy's happy, and so am I. I could ask you, just between us chickens, if it was actually Babineau who died out there in the woods, but I don't really want to know."
"So how does Library Al fit into the scenario?" Hodges asks.
"He doesn't," Pete puts his paper plate aside. "Alvin Brooks killed himself last night."
"Oh, Christ," Hodges says. "While he was in county?"
"Yes."
"They didn't have him on suicide watch after all this?"
"They did, and none of the inmates are supposed to have anything capable of cutting or stabbing, but he got hold of a ballpoint pen somehow. Might have been a guard who gave it to him, but it was probably another inmate. He drew Z's all over the walls, all over his bunk, and all over himself. Then he took the pen's metal cartridge out of the barrel and used it to..."
"Stop," Barbara says. She looks very pale in the winter light falling on them from above. "We get the idea."
Hodges says, "So the thinking is, what, he was Babineau's accomplice?" "Fell under his influence," Pete says. "Or maybe both of them fell under someone else's influence, but let's not go there, okay?
The thing to concentrate on now is that the three of you are in the clear.
There won't be any citations this time, or city freebies.
It's okay, Jerome says. Me and Holly have still got at least 4 years left on our bus passes anyway.
Not that you ever use yours now that you're hardly ever here, Barbara says. You should give it to me.
It's non-transferable, Jerome says smugly. I better hold on to it. Wouldn't want you to get in any trouble with the law. Besides, soon you'll be going places with Doris. Just don't go too far, if you know what I mean.
You're being childish,
Barbara turns to Pete.
How many suicides were there in all?
Pete sighs. 14 over the last 5 days. 9 of them had Zappets, which are now as dead as their owners. The oldest was 24, the youngest 13. One was a boy from a family that was, according to the neighbors, fairly weird about religion, the kind that makes fundamentalist Christians look liberal. He took his parents and kid brother with him, shotgun. The 5 of them fall silent for a moment. At the table on the left, the card players burst into howls of laughter over something. Pete breaks the silence. And there have been over 40 attempts. Jerome whistles.
Yeah, I know. It's not in the papers, and the TV stations are sitting on it. Even Murder and Mayhem.
This is a police nickname for WKMM, an indie station that has taken If It Bleeds, It Leads as an article of faith.
But of course, a lot of those attempts, maybe even most of them, end up getting blabbed about on the social media sites, and that breeds still more. I hate those sites. But this will settle. Suicide clusters always do.
Eventually, Hodges says. But with social media or without it, with Brady or without him, suicide is a fact of life.
He looks over at the card players as he says this, especially the 2 baldies. One looks good, as Hodges himself looks good, but the other is cadaverous and hollow-eyed. 1 foot in the grave, and the other on a banana peel, Hodges' father would have said. And the thought that comes to him is too complicated, too fraught with a terrible mixture of anger and sorrow to be articulated. It's about how some people carelessly squander what others would sell their souls to have. A healthy, pain-free body. And why? Because they're too blind, too emotionally scarred, or too self-involved to see past the earth's dark curve to the next sunrise, which always comes if one continues to draw breath.
More cake? Barbara asks. Nope, got a split. But I will sign your cast, if I may. Please, Barbara says, and write something witty.
That's far beyond Pete's pay grade, Hodges says.
Watch your mouth, Kermit.
Pete drops to one knee like a swain about to propose and begins writing carefully on Barbara's cast. When he's finished, he stands up and looks at Hodges.
Now tell me the truth about how you're feeling.
Damn good. I've got a patch that controls the pain a lot better than the pills, and they're kicking me loose tomorrow. I can't wait to sleep in my own bed.
He pauses, then says, I'm going to beat this thing.
Pete's waiting for the elevator when Holly catches up to him.
It meant a lot to Bill, she says, that you came, and that you still want to give him that toast.
It's not so good, is it? Pete says.
No.
He reaches out to hug her, but Holly steps back. She does allow him to take her hand and give it a brief squeeze.
Not so good.
Crap.
Yes, crap. Crap is right. He doesn't deserve this. But since he's stuck with it, he needs his friends to stand by him. You will, won't you?
Of course I will. And don't count him out yet, Holly. Where there's life, there's hope. I know it's a cliché, but... He shrugs.
I do have hope. I have Holly hope.
You can't say she's as weird as ever, Pete thinks, but she's still peculiar. He sort of likes it, actually.
Just make sure he keeps that toast relatively clean, okay? I will.
And hey, he outlived Hartsfield. No matter what else happens, he's got that.
We'll always have Paris, kid,
Holly says in a Bogart drawl. Yes, she's still peculiar. One of a kind, actually.
Listen, Gibney, you need to take care of yourself, too, no matter what happens. He'd hate it if you didn't. I know, Holly says, and goes back to the solarium
where she and Jerome will clean up the remains of the birthday party. She tells herself that it isn't necessarily the last one, and tries to convince herself of that. She doesn't entirely succeed, but she continues to have Holly hope. 8 months later. When Jerome shows up at Fairlawn, 2 days after the funeral and at 10 on the dot, as promised, Holly is already there, on her knees at the head of the grave. She's not praying, she's planting a chrysanthemum. She doesn't look up when his shadow falls over her. She knows who it is. This was the arrangement they made after she told him she didn't know if she could make it all the way through the funeral.
"I'll try," she said, "but I'm not good with those fracking things. I may have to book." "You plant these in the fall," she says now. "I don't know much about plants, so I got a how-to guide. The writing was only so-so, but the directions are easy to follow."
"That's good." Jerome sits down cross-legged at the end of the plot where the grass begins. Holly scoops dirt carefully with her hands, still not looking at him.
"I told you I might have to book. They all stared at me when I left, but I just couldn't stay. If I had, they would have wanted me to stand up there in front of the coffin and talk about him, and I couldn't. Not in front of all those people. I bet his daughter is mad."
"Probably not," Jerome says.
"I hate funerals. I came to the city for one. Did you know that?"
Jerome does, but says nothing, just lets her finish.
"My aunt died. She was Olivia Trelawney's mother. That's where I met Bill, at that funeral. I ran out of that one, too. I was sitting behind the funeral parlor, smoking a cigarette, feeling terrible, and that's where he found me. Do you understand?" At last she looks up at him. "He found me."
"I get it, Holly. I do."
"He opened a door for me. Went into the world. He gave me something to do that made a difference."
"Same here." She wipes her eyes almost angrily.
"This is just so fracking poopy."
"Got that right, but he wouldn't want you to go backward. That's the last thing he'd want."
"I won't," she says. "You know he left me the company, right? The insurance money and everything else went to Allie, but the company is mine. I can't run it by myself, so I asked Pete if he'd like to work for me, just part-time."
"And he said?"
"He said yes, because retirement sucked already. It should be okay. I'll run down the skippers and deadbeats on my computer, and he'll go out and get them. Or serve the subpoenas, if that's the job. But it won't be like it was. Working for Bill. Working with Bill. Those were the happiest days of my life."
She thinks that over.
"I guess the only happy days of my life. I felt, I don't know."
"Valued?" Jerome suggests.
"Yes, valued."
"You should have felt that way," Jerome says. "Because you were very valuable, and still are." She gives the plant a final critical look, dusts dirt from her hands and the knees of her pants, and sits down next to him.
"He was brave, wasn't he? At the end, I mean."
"Yes."
"Yeah."
She smiles a little.
"That's what Bill would have said. Not yes, but yeah."
"Yeah," he agrees.
"Jerome, would you put your arm around me?"
He does.
"The first time I met you, when we found the stealth program Brady loaded into my cousin Olivia's computer, I was afraid of you."
"I know," Jerome says.
"Not because you were black."
"Black is whack," Jerome says, smiling. "I think we agreed on that much right from the jump."
"But because you were a stranger. You were from outside. I was scared of outside people and outside things. I still am, but not as much as I was then."
"I know."
"I loved him,"
Holly says, looking at the chrysanthemum. It is a brilliant orange-red below the gray gravestone, which bears a simple message, Kermit William Hodges. And below the dates, end of watch.
I loved him so much.
Yeah, Jerome says. So did I. She looks up at him, her face timid and hopeful. Beneath the graying bangs, it is almost the face of a child.
You'll always be my friend, won't you?
Always. He squeezes her shoulders, which are heartbreakingly thin. During Hodge's final 2 months, she lost 10 pounds she couldn't afford to lose. He knows his mother and Barbara are just waiting to feed her up. Always, Holly.
I know, she says.
Then why did you ask?
Because it's so good to hear you say it.
End of watch, Jerome thinks. He hates the sound of that, but it's right. It's right. And this is better than the funeral. Being here with Holly on this sunny late summer morning is much better.
Jerome, I'm not smoking.
That's good. They sit quiet for a little while, looking at the chrysanthemum burning its colors at the base of the headstone.
Jerome?
What, Holly?
Would you like to go to a movie with me?
Yes, he says, then corrects himself. Yeah.
We'll leave a seat empty between us, just to put our popcorn in.
Okay.
Because I hate putting it on the floor, where there are probably roaches and maybe even rats.
I hate it, too. What do you want to see?
Something that will make us laugh and laugh.
Works for me. He smiles at her. Holly smiles back. They leave Fairlawn and walk back out into the world together. August 30th, 2015. One last thing from Stephen King. End of Watch is fiction, but the high rate of suicides, both in the United States and in many other countries where these books are read, is all too real. The National Suicide Prevention Hotline number given in this book is also real. It's 1-800-273-TALK. If you are feeling poopy, as Holly Gibney would say, give them a call, because things can get better, and if you give them a chance, they usually do. Stephen King.
End of Watch was written by Stephen King and read by Will Patton. Editing and post-production by Mike Ticino for Common Mode. Music by Matt Cartsonis. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Michael Noble. End of Watch was produced and directed by Christina Zarafanidis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. End of Watch is available in print from Scribner. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Revival by Stephen King, read by David Morse, and Dr. Sleep by Stephen King, read by Will Patton.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.